morning of July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart and her navigator, Fred Noonan, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. 80 years later, all over the world, lie scattered pieces of their puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart Podcast.
Boys, I'd like to introduce your commander, Miss Amelia Earhart. Dear Lord Slim Gordon, your navigator.
How do you do?
And Bill Stelz.
Hello, Bill.
Best pilot working today.
How much fuel do you lose because of these?
Costs us at least 400 gallons.
Well, why have them?
The owner wants to protect her plane in case you have to ditch it at sea.
But those are decisions I have to make, not somebody else. They're not making this trip. We are.
But she owns the plane. This is still America, Miss Earhart. Ownership is the trump card.
Sad to say, but dollars for planes in the air.
I wonder if they can keep us up there. Not that I've ever had enough to try. Our job is to figure out how to fly this beauty without gasoline.
We all have pivotal moments in our lives. A moment that plants the seeds for the person that we'll become. For Amelia Earhart, that moment came when she was a little girl in Atchison, Kansas. On episode 25 of the Chasing Earhart podcast, we sit down with educator, author, and project guest Mark Weakland to discuss his book, When Amelia Earhart Built a Roller Coaster. Join us as we discuss this single event way back from Amelia's childhood that set in motion the events that would create the biggest icon in aviation history. Mark, thank you very much for sitting in on the podcast. We appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome, Chris. It's great to be here. A lot of fun, too. This is cool.
So what I want to start out with, I always ask the same two questions of every guest we have because I think the answers are very interesting. Can we start off by having you state a little bit about your education and your background and your professional background to the people listening out there?
Sure. Yep. I live here in Western Pennsylvania right now, and I've lived here for almost all of my life. My educational background, I did some schooling at the University of Duquesne in Pittsburgh, and I also did schooling at the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh at the main campus, and I got my undergraduate there. I was kind of bent on being a doctor at first, and then I morphed into a musician, then I got a degree in psychology, and with that, you know, at the time you could buy a cup of coffee with that and a quarter. So I did music in Pittsburgh for a bunch of years, just played music and did some other jobs. And then I eventually went back to school at the University of Pittsburgh, and I got my master's degree in education. I have education in my family's background. My mother is a teacher, and my grandfather was a school principal, and I have aunts who are teachers, et cetera. So, and I was interested in working with kids, and I kind of am a lifelong learner. So I got involved in education after kind of following my bliss and playing in rock bands and funk bands and jazz bands and stuff. And I did that when I was about 27. So yeah, that's my background in my schooling there.
So the second question I always ask, because this is always an interesting answer typically, is how did Amelia Earhart come into your life?
Yeah, so Amelia Earhart, because she's, I mean, such a widely recognized person and such kind of an icon in America, she was always on my radar, so to speak. I mean, I always knew who she was, and I had known that she, you know, had done the transatlantic flight, and that she was kind of this character who was larger than life and had disappeared mysteriously and all that kind of stuff. But it was just kind of a general knowledge, you know, a person that was in my mind in general knowledge speaking. And she came into my life in the form of this book when I started to write books for children. And I've been doing that I've been writing for kids since about 2000. But it took me about 9 years to actually get a book published with a nice publishing firm. And in 2009, I published my first book with Capstone Publishing. And Capstone has an imprint called Picture Window Books. And it was the Picture Window Books editors that contacted me about Amelia Earhart. And so that's really where she kind of came back to me. And I went a lot deeper with understanding what she had done and, you know, who she was as a person, and specifically to this book, what kind of a kid she was, you know, who she was when she was a child. And I forget exactly when this book was written, but probably like, you know, it probably started on 2014 or 2015. So it was a fairly long time that I really, you know, sat and thought about Amelia Earhart.
And you touched on it a little bit. You're an educator and you're a writer. Can you tell us why you decided that you wanted to write books and why you were drawn to writing about historical figures and just more specifically historical figures for kids?
Sure. So my kind of, I've always been a journaler, if that's a word, which is kind of hard to say, the rural juror, it's a journaler. So I've always kept a journal and, you know, so, and I've been writing tunes like songs and compositions because I'm a musician. So I did that for a long time, but I never really thought of myself formally as a writer until, like I said, around 2000 or so. For some reason, I kind of got this bug where I set myself a goal. I want to see if I can write a book for children. As a longtime teacher in an elementary school, you know, I was around books all the time, and I was always trying to impress upon the kids I was working with the love of reading, and I'm an avid reader myself. You know, I grew up loving books. And so, you know, I had set a bunch of different kind of goals for myself in life, and to do music or to write music, to do this, to do that. And for some reason, I kind of just set this goal to see if I could write a book for kids around 2000. And I didn't really know what I was doing. And I never have been formally educated as a writer. So I kind of, I learned by trial and error. And I just really wanted to write because I guess I was around a lot of books and I saw a lot of kids who love books. And I thought, I bet I could do that. And I was all, and there was also kind of this movement at the time where like, everybody, like Jimmy Buffett's writing a book for kids and Jamie Lee Curtis is writing a book for kids. And not that they can't do that, but I always thought they had such a leg up, you know, just by virtue of their celebrity. And I thought, well, if they can do that, then, and maybe they aren't the world's best writer, I can certainly try to do it. So that's really why I wanted to write a book for kids. It just seemed like a really cool thing to do. So I was happy to do it. And then, so when I joined the capstone kind of writing cadre, just to make it clear to everyone who's listening, Capstone Publishing and their imprint, Picture Window, they do books for children, but they write in what's called an educational market. So it's not like a trade book market, a trade paperback, or kind of more classic children's literature. It's more literature that's targeted at schools, although the books themselves have a wonderful look to them, and they aspire to be, you know, always great writing. But the work that I get through Capstone and through Picture Window is work for hire. So there's someone there at Capstone and there's someone there at Picture Window. I'm not quite sure how they do this, like some kind of committee or maybe it's the editors, but somebody somewhere, they sit down, they come up with an idea and they go through some kind of a process and then they reach out to their authors like myself and they say, hey, Mark Weakland, could you write this book? And oftentimes it's this weird process of, like there used to be a radio show on, I think it was NPR, called The Splendid Table. And one of the segments was like, you have to take like whatever in your cabinet, you know, like there's some honey and there's some old bread and there's a tomato and an avocado and an artichoke heart and some tofu. Can you make dinner out of all this stuff? Well, sometimes my assignments seem like that. Like, you know, my first book was all about turning nasty substances into something that you can turn into energy. Sometimes I get an assignment like, we want you to write a book about physics and laws of thermodynamics or whatever, but it has to be for fourth graders and it can be no more than like 1500 words and it has to include zombies. So they come up with these ideas and I try to do the best I can to write. And at some point in time, one of the editors contacted me and said, we have this great idea. And I thought it was a great idea too, to write about great American leaders, well-known American leaders, but tell it from the point of view from them as kids, when they were children. Because it's a book for children, we want to really focus on their life as children. And so that's where the idea came from. I didn't come up with it. It was the editors and the people at Capstone Press, maybe possibly my editor, Shelley Lyons, who's a fabulous editor. She might've been the one that came up with it. I don't know.
And, you know, that must be tough. I mean, you kind of expanded on, you know, kind of what they throw at you and just having to kind of write. That must be tough from a writing standpoint to go that route. What kind of what kind of research goes into a book like, you know, the Amelia Earhart book and some of the other ones you've written? I mean, what, when they say, okay, this is your topic, this is what we want from you, what's, as a writer, and I think this would be helpful for a lot of the younger folks who are following the project, what do you do next? What is your process and how does that work?
Right. So I'm thankful that I'm a lifelong learner and I find very, you know, many, many things interesting. And I would encourage any writer to kind of just try to think about everything that you can and be open to experiences and knowledge at whatever, in whatever shape or form. So I do have sometimes have an advantage because I have a wide background in thinking about and learning about the sciences. So I've written a bunch of science books with them. And I have kind of like loose and sometimes not very deep, but kind of wide general knowledge about a lot of things. That being said, for any book like this, you know, I have to go deeper. And fortunately, there's this thing called the internet that's out there, you know. And in the old days, back in the day, you had to go to the library, you know, exclusively and just look through the microfiche or whatever, go to the stacks and find other books that were written. Maybe there's a primary source out there, which is great. But nowadays, so much of the research that can be done is on the internet. And so it's just a wonderful tool. So my research is pretty much, you know, like I go to the internet first and I look around at the various sources, and you're always trying to figure out, you know, which are the more legitimate sources and which are the less legitimate sources. So I go and I search around there. If there's an autobiography out there, I always grab up the autobiography and I typically go to the library and get it because I like the book in my hand. And thankfully on Amelia, there was an autobiography that she wrote, which is great. And like I did Martin Luther King, he has an autobiography out there. Wilma Rudolph, I did a book on, she wrote an autobiography, not very well known and in some places kind of not well written, but nonetheless, it was an autobiography. So, you know, I go there and typically I start with an autobiography if I can do that. And I like to go to sources like, you know, the Amelia Earhart organization. Sometimes there's an official museum associated with folks. And I always go there, you know, because that's a wealth of information. And oftentimes they'll have citations and kind of first source papers that you can kind of get. And so I do all that. And in this case, it's really kind of sifting through all this information, trying to find some anecdotes that speaks directly to when they were kids. And even, it's interesting, like as I've been reading autobiographies, oftentimes, even the person themselves, like Martin Luther King Jr., he didn't write extensively about when he was a kid. He wrote about when he was an adult. And that's true of Amelia too. I don't know if, you know, they just kind of get to the point where they've had so many things happen in their life where their like childhood is just kind of this, you know, kind of fading memory, or we're all rooted so strongly in our childhoods, but sometimes the people themselves don't write about it. And certainly biographers oftentimes are writing for an adult audience, and the, you know, the childhood aspect of a book is sometimes maybe only a chapter, if that. So it was kind of hard to kind of cobble together all of these little anecdotes about Amelia being a kid.
And you touch on that's a good segue. The running theme seems to be, you know, tying these figures to an event that does take place in their childhood. And you touched on that a little earlier. Can you talk about, you know, choosing that route to go, whether it was kind of chosen by the editors or whether it was like a collective thing, and how you guys kind of came up with that idea of kind of let's tie something like, you know, the roller coaster event or some of the other stuff that you've done. Can you talk about that kind of that approach to it?
Yeah. So the simple answer to how it came about is what, you know, we talked about a little bit before, is that this was an assignment that was given to me. But from when I'm then taking that assignment and thinking about the audience that I'm writing for, which in this case, you know, might be a second grader or a third grader or a fourth grader. I think the job of any author, whether it's someone like myself writing for children, or when I wrote my middle grade novel that hopefully will be coming out soon, or if I'm writing for teachers when I do teacher books, or whoever, if you're Stephen King, you know, you have an audience. If you're this writer, you have this audience. And your job as a writer is to identify, is to meld your own interests and your own style with a greater universal appeal. So, you know, you want to find stories that are going to resonate with people. You want to try to think about, well, will my audience find this interesting? Will my audience find this informative? Will my audience find this entertaining? You know, how can we connect on the heart level? All of those kinds of things. So when I was thinking about, you know, which of these things, once I had the assignment given to me, now it's like, well, what am I going to put into this box that's been given to me? Because that's up to me as a writer. So I'm trying to think about, well, what might be fun for kids to see? What might be informative for them? What fits into the overall arc of the story as far as her growth as a person who was brave and adventurous and had this can-do spirit? You know, what kind of a little story can I tell that will show that Amelia Earhart, who turned out to do all these amazing things, was, as it says in the beginning of the book, a child just like you and me. So, you know, I want to kind of get something in there, and sometimes my editors help me with this, get something in there that kids can relate to and say, oh, well, I see that myself. And, you know, no matter who that child is, no matter where they live, you know, what little story can we tell that talks to their fears or their bravery or whatever.
Yeah, your segues are great. They helped me a lot with this interview. So it's important to note that while she was an icon, I mean, she was like you just mentioned, she was just like every other kid out there. That's a major thing to get across to young, you know, influential readers. As a writer and as an educator, how important is it to get that factor ingrained in your reader, especially knowing that you're speaking to second and third graders possibly that are going to be reading this book?
Right. So two things. How important is it? And then how do I get it across? Well, it's very important. I mean, it's just so important for kids to make a connection to the book that we're reading. You know, one of my many hats that I wear is as a reading specialist and a literacy person who's interested in furthering the field by helping teachers in schools. And so I talk with a lot of teachers and a lot of principals about issues of literacy. And one big issue in literacy is, how do you motivate children to read? How do you get kids to read, especially in this age of Facebook and Zoom and video games and on, all the screen time that we have? You know, how do we get a kid to pick up a book? Well, they're going to pick up a book when they're motivated to read it. So maybe they are motivated because they see a connection with that person. So Amelia was a young girl, and I'm a young girl. Or Amelia was somebody who is interested in airplanes, and I'm a child who's interested in airplanes. And so then I'm motivated to read that story. So it's really important that kids have a connection, and the better your writing is, the more you can tell a story, the better able you're to make that connection. And then certainly I have the advantage of having this be a picture book. So I don't have to do it all through words. The illustrator, I had a wonderful, you know, illustrator for this book, and she did a great job with the illustrations. And oftentimes they will convey a big part of the story that helps make that connection with kids and gets the child to understand in a visual way that, oh, this person was just like me. In fact, I'm working on an extension of this set of biographies. So I'm just finishing up a biography of Neil Armstrong and a biography of Walt Disney. And one of the Walt Disney illustrations shows him on the farm with his favorite pig, Skinny, and who is a runt. And the illustration shows Walt running through the field with Skinny trotting behind him. And Walt has a wooden sword in his hand. And I didn't, you know, that was strictly the illustrator's choice. And that, I think that makes a connection with any kid who's kind of, rambunctious and shows adventure and shows a sense of imagination. And the illustrator did this in the Amelia book too, you know, when she just depicts Amelia from the very get-go with her arms outspread, looking up at the sky, running through the field. And, you know, I think that's a thing that any child who's been outside running, looking up at the sky, can connect with. So it's super important. And then we just try to connect through our words that we use as writers, and in this case, to the illustrations that we're making.
And I want to talk a little bit just about, like, you know, her as a child. So she's obviously not conventional by any stretch of the imagination,
right?
Especially for that time. You know, she played with the boys, she played rough, she didn't like to wear dresses, and most importantly, she was a dreamer. But not about getting married and having a family. She was dreaming instead of you know, going out on these adventures and living a life of excitement and wonder. How much of that attitude do you think carried an influence on the woman that she would become? I mean, as a child dreaming that way and kind of it kind of starting young, planting that seed, you know, whether it's internal or, you know, by external, you know, parents or whatever, how much of that you think influenced the woman she would become?
Well, that's a really nice statement to make, because I do think it came, you know, her sense of adventure and independence and dreaming and kind of really breaking outside of the boundaries of what was acceptable at the time for young girls. I think it did come from her parents, but there must have been a part of it that was in her too. And that's just who she was, you know, the spirit that she was born with. And it was, I think, just as kind of a dabbler in Amelia Earhart here, you know, I guess when I only went so deep with all this, but even as a dabbler, it's huge. I mean, I just think that her being was very apparent from a very young age, and that she was going to take that interest in not only adventure and dreaming, but she just seemed to be a kid that was very aware of what society was telling girls that they should do and how they should be, and kind of saying, forget that, man. I'm definitely not into it. I'm just not into that. And I'm pushing back against it. Like, she seemed to actively kind of foster that sense of, like, I'm not going to go there. And, you know, even though I have a little anecdote about her looking around at jobs that men did and forming a scrapbook of those ideas. She was pretty young when she was doing that kind of thing. And so she was very aware that, one, she wasn't that person, and two, she might be able to she might be able to take the bull by the horn, so to speak, and make a life of her own that would be outside the realm of what most girls did. She wasn't interested in getting married. She wasn't interested in having kids. She definitely wasn't interested in being a teacher or a nurse. She wanted to do what the boys did, and she wanted to become what a guy could do. And so I just thought that was really interesting. And at a young age, you know, like when she first came into contact with an airplane, I think she was around 10, it didn't make that big of an impression on her. You know, so it wasn't like some kids are, like, oh, I want to work for Walt Disney World, or, oh, I want to become an astronaut, you know, when I'm 10. Or I think she was more of like, I want to become something that's adventurous and daring and probably in the world of men. And then later on, she really kind of attached herself and came to love flying. So I think that's what it was. But her being as a person, she seemed to be really kind of amazingly formed about, I'm a tomboy, I'm rough and tumble, I'm an adventurer, and I'm going to go out into life and do something like that. So.
And you touched on it in the beginning of that last statement, and I want to come back around to it. Amelia's mother, Amy, she encouraged Amelia and Muriel's religious spirit. She sewed them gym suits to play in, and she was quoted as saying, and this is from your book, I don't believe in bringing up nice little girls who only play with dolls and wear dresses. She was a strong female support and role model for both of her girls. You touched on it a little bit, but can we go a little more into that as far as how important was that influence on Amelia herself, and how important do you think it is for parents to influence their kids and to kind of sort of light that fire up underneath them and just kind of get them kind of going in the direction that they're meant to go in?
Yeah. Well, I mean, as far as Amelia goes, I would have liked to have known her mother, because she seems like a pretty amazing person. And she was a visionary, you know, and she seemed very progressive and very aware of letting her daughter be who she wanted to be. And probably she was that way herself. And also, I do have to give a nod to her father, too, because Amelia's dad really encouraged both his girls, Amelia and her sister Muriel, to be the people that they were into being. And he fostered their rough and tumble nature. You know, like, I think in the book I mentioned, Amelia's father bought them both footballs, you know, so he was out here, your kids, here are the footballs, go out and play. He was the one that bought Amelia a gun. This just as a small aside, this is an anecdote that didn't make it into the book, and I wish the publishers would have put it in the book, but they didn't. He bought her a gun, like a rifle, when she was about 9. And this caught, and Amelia's grandmother was very much taken aback by this. Like, what, you're buying your daughter a gun, you know, and she's a rifle and she's only 9 years old? But, you know, he was fine with that, and that's what people did. And so Amelia had this rifle when she was very at a very young age, and she got it in her head at one point that she's going to combat the plague, because she had read about the plague in Panama, and she knew it was carried by rats. And although there were no rat or plague-carrying rats in Kansas at the time where she was, she had it in her head that there could be, and she didn't want the plague to be in Kansas. So she's going to be proactive. So she's out in the barn with her rifle, like shooting at rats, and gathering up rats and kind of like tying them together in a bundle by their tail. And then she takes it into Grandma and says, look what I have. You know, I'm protecting the world against the plague. Well, this, I guess, put her grandma over the edge and her gun got confiscated. But in any case, you know, that was brought on by her father giving her. So her father was very influential too. And as for nowadays, you know, I mean, parents are, they're just immensely, hugely, ultimately important in the lives of children. And so you can't, you know, do enough to support kids as a parent. I don't have children of my own, but I'm around a lot of kids, and I've been, you know, as a teacher and stuff, I see the effects of great parenting, the effects of good parenting, and unfortunately the effects of bad parenting, or sometimes even no parenting at all. So, yeah. And, you know, I mean, people hopefully will guide their children, not force it upon them. But definitely there's time to light the fire, time to give direction, and kind of time just to be supportive or whatever.
Thank you so much for sharing that story with the rat story. That's a very famous story too as well. But
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's one that people might not know, that, you know, don't know a whole lot about. You know, Amelia Earhart is you know, that was, you know, to have that rifle and to do that, and you know, I think it speaks to you know, what she would become later. Is, you know, she was trying to stop the plague, so she had it in this mind of this ultimate goal that she wanted, and she was doing, and she wasn't afraid to do her part and actually go out there. And like she said, you know, later on in life, the most effective way to do it is to do it. And so I think that stories like that, and the roller coaster story that, you know, that you write about in the book, is it plants those seeds. It really does, because she just, as she gets older, you know, expands upon that and gets much more fantastical and all that. But you can see that the seeds are sown really early in her life. So that's really neat.
Exactly, Chris. I couldn't agree more. Yeah, they're all there, and they just manifest in different ways.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the roller coaster. We'll get into that, because we actually just visited the Atchison Birthplace Museum, and you know, we talked with Lou Foudre there, and we talked with Katie Evans, who's the manager of the museum there, and they actually have a replica of the actual roller coaster, much smaller scale, but a replica of the one that they actually built out back. And we stood maybe 10 feet from 15 feet, maybe, from where this actual event happened, which is pretty cool. It's a little different looking now, but, you know, they kind of pointed out, yeah, that was about where it was at, and everything. So you touched on, you know, editors assisting and kind of helping you, you know, kind of get to these ideas and everything. Was the roller coaster idea, was that something that they kind of said, we want you to pick something from your childhood, and that was something you picked? Or did they already have the roller coaster idea ingrained, and they said, we want you to kind of expand upon it, research it, and write about it?
Yeah, they pretty much turned me loose. Like, the process is, they give me the very general outlines. In this case, once again, there's like a word count. Typically, there's a number of pages I'm supposed to hit. There's a grade level that I'm supposed to get. And then, of course, there's the subject matter. And the subject matter was Amelia, and the style or the genre or whatever. The focus is, of course, as her as a child. Fun-loving, adventurous in spirit, like, what are her core personalities? How does that manifest later when she's older? And other than that, it's up to me to kind of fill in all of the stories in there. So as I was researching, like I said, I'm a dabbler in Amelia Earhart. As I was researching, I saw that the roller coaster was one that's very famous. And then there's a quote from her sister that was like, I forget exactly what I wrote in the book, but it's like, you're flying, or Amelia herself says, I'm flying, you know? So that kind of worked right in there. And I gathered all of these stories together, the roller coaster being one of the central ones. And then at the end of it, the editors or the team at Capstone decides on what the title of the book is going to be. And that is the title that they chose. So they felt at some point, I don't know how they came about this decision, but they felt that that was one of the central, you know, ideas and illustrations or stories in the book. And so they felt that that would be the one for the title, and that's what they called it.
Okay, so now for everyone who's listening out there who may not know the story or who may not know much about it, let's get into it. Can you tell us what happened on that day with the roller coaster? What happened with that?
Yeah, well, so I she's there with her uncle, and I have to say too that Amelia, because of her father working on the railroad, at least this is my understanding, and you can back this up, Chris, or not, but because her father worked on the railroad, she was very interested in mechanical things. So she was mechanically inclined, and that kind of goes along with like what the guys were doing, you know, her kind of interest in guys and boys. So she was mechanically inclined. She's always fiddling around with stuff, and her dad is involved in the railroad. And so she's kind of probably got this picture of rails and things moving along on rails and zooming. And also, I guess she went back and forth, right, between her home and the home of her grandparents. And that would have been on railway. So she's always moving around. So, you know, they're out there in the summer and they're looking for things to do. And with the help of her uncle, they build this like little, this rail, and I'm looking at the picture of it here. It's all wooden, and it's got the like the two rails coming down that are basically boards, and then it's got some boards at the bottom, and it kind of runs off of a kind of concrete culvert kind of thing almost. So there's lift at the end, right? It's like a ramp almost. And it's just basically a box, and they grease down the rails with lard, with a bunch of lard, and Amelia's like going to be the first one in it. So they stick her in the box at the top, and I'm sure somebody probably held it in place, and she says ready, set, go, or something like that, and they release her, and very quickly, faster I think than she probably even realized she would go, she's sliding down those rails. And she's in the box, she hits the bottom, gains some air, and crash lands onto the ground and tumbles out. And rather than being hurt or surprised, she's like totally like, that was awesome. She's jazzed. And she was so excited. It's, you know, it's just like flying, she says. It's just like flying to her sister. And you see the illustration of it. It's not that grand, and you were there. So it's probably not like this, you know, grandiose thing like way off the ground or whatever, but you get a picture of yourself as a kid and how excited you are, you know, when you're a child.
Yeah, it's fascinating, and I think that was you know, that's something that, you know, if you're 10 feet off the ground, you might as well be 100 feet off the ground. And I think for her was her first, you know, her first taste and her first experience. And I think you know, technically, I mean, that's the first time that Amelia Earhart ever flew, you know, before, of course, you look at the time that she was taken up by Frank Hawks later and for the first time. And that's when she made that famous quote where she said, by the time I was 200, 300 feet off the ground, I knew I had to fly. Mm-hmm. But she had had that experience with the roller coaster, the homemade roller coaster that was built. And I just want to ask you, you know, your opinion on this. Do you think, well, did that roller coaster, building that roller coaster and everything and doing that experience, did that light a fire under Amelia Earhart, do you think?
You mean as far as flying?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you had mentioned earlier, and it's true, she first time she saw an airplane, she wasn't that impressed, but the first time she went up in one, I often wonder if, and I was talking to my project coordinator about this a couple weeks ago, I often wonder if those two events are cohesive. Like if she kind of, you know, you have events in your life when you're little that you remember, you know, like you mentioned earlier, a lot of your childhood kind of fades, you don't really remember a lot of details, but there are some standout events, and I would imagine that that would be one of them. You know, the roller coaster that she built with her uncle and her sister. I wonder if the first time she flew was taken up by Frank Hawks, if that was a cohesive event, if she kind of thought back on that, you know, that original event of the roller coaster. And I wonder if that lit a fire underneath her, or if that just helped fuel the fire that she already had there, maybe, once she got that first taste of air,
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible, Chris. I don't really know. I mean, if I was David McCullough and somebody who was going to write like a full-length biography on Amelia, or I was like really trying to write a thicker biography of when she was a kid, like, and if I could find some more kind of firsthand accounts of what she actually thought, if they were written down, then we would know for sure. It's possible that it is cohesive and that a series of events kind of, you know, coalesced in her mind and helped kind of even unconsciously or subconsciously, you know, move her along the path towards airplanes and flight and being above it all. You know, our lives take there's so many different little things working on us that can sometimes take us in different directions, or sometimes we take the little things and meld them all into our one big direction that we don't even maybe know we're working on. I honestly don't know. It's nice to think so. I can't prove it, you know.
I wish we could.
Yeah, for sure.
So often today, we're going to skip ahead a little bit because I know you kind of answered a few of the questions in previous questions. So rather than re-ask them, so often today, young people look up and idolize, you know, celebrities and, you know, and superheroes and comics and things like that. As an educator, how important for you is it to showcase the lives of people like Amelia Earhart and all these famous icons to younger generations now that may not be familiar with an Amelia Earhart or a Martin Luther King or an Abraham Lincoln or someone like that? I mean, how important, crucial is that for you as an educator to showcase that?
Well, I feel very fortunate that I have the opportunity to showcase these kinds of things, and I've been given the opportunity to write about these, I mean, amazing people. They're not like me. I mean, they really are special people. And what they accomplish is really astounding. But along with that kind of, maybe they achieve a certain celebrity or maybe they achieve a certain greatness. But along with that, I think there's the idea too of possibility, and that's why they're American leaders, you know? And I think like an idea that kind of supports what has happened to Thomas Edison or Amelia Earhart or Walt Disney is this possibility that America provides. It's a possibility of opportunity. And whether you achieve greatness like Walt Disney and you come up with a multi-million dollar company, or Amelia Earhart, you do the first, you know, that you go on a transatlantic flight, I think the bigger idea is the possibility and the opportunity to do something with your life. And that might be my possibility is like, I never thought I would write a book, you know? And so, but America gives me an opportunity to do that. And cause we have a lot of freedoms in this country, and I have a certain amount of, you know, a lifestyle and a certain amount of money to pursue things in life. And I'm not limited. And, you know, our political system is able to kind of foster this opportunity that we can take advantage of. And all of these leaders were able to do that. And so undergirding, you know, supporting their amazing minds and their fearlessness and that kind of stuff too is the American story. And I think the American story is the land of opportunity, that they had opportunity to grow and expand and the freedom to be a girl, you know, that could wear bloomers and run around and act like a boy. Because in some countries, you could not do that. Amelia Earhart never would have happened in some countries. So there's that opportunity, I think, is another idea in these books. And I think it's true in Amelia also.
I've often said in my talks to kids that Amelia Earhart was a real-life superhero. She really was. She did these amazing things and accomplished feats that no one believed, you know, she could accomplish. I mean, my favorite Amelia Earhart story of all time is the autogyro story. I don't know if you read about that, but you know, there's this experimental aircraft, you know, this autogyro that's almost like a helicopter type unit, that, is being developed, and, you know, they need someone to test it. And Amelia Earhart is, you know, she's at that time a really huge name. And I thought if we could, just like now, if we can attach a big name to this, you know, our product will be successful. So they bring her out there. They strap her into this thing. They do some tests with her, and the guy's explaining the autogyro to her. And you know, 15 minutes into the explanation, she says, okay, I got it. And she takes this thing and flies it halfway across the country, this experimental craft. Could have died at any time. And then after a while, she's like, yeah, you know, I'm not really into it so much. And says, you know, here's your craft back. Uh-huh. You know, that ties directly to the roller coaster story. If you really look at the two, I mean, you know, she mm-hmm. just went for it. She just did things. It was, she was a fly by the seat of her pants kind of woman, obviously. I think that really speaks to her fearlessness and her courage and having that kind of, you know, that kind of fearlessness and that courage to do whatever you want to do and to not let anything ever stop you. Mm-hmm. And I think that was, you know, that's something I can really speak to. It spoke to kids then, and I think it certainly speaks to kids now. For people like her and for people like, you know, a Lincoln or a Disney or a Martin Luther King, you touched on the importance of it. I mean, how, as an educator, how do you introduce these people? Is it self-directed learning with books like this where they can kind of pick up a book and start reading? Do you ingrain those ideas and ingrain these names in them in their, you know, first and second and third grade? How does that work? And what's been your approach to that in teaching?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that it's both, you know, I think just kind of through casual mentioning and having lots of books around, and just general discussion, things that are along those general lines, you can foster that love. And sometimes kids have a natural, like, just, I don't know, they glom on to someone for some reason, and they're so interested in, you know, they go through the dinosaur phase, or they go through this phase, that phase. And there was a first grader or second grader who wrote me recently about how much she loved the Martin Luther King book. She really could identify with this Martin Luther King book that I had written. So there's that. But to go just a little bit deeper with that, as an educator and as a person who talks to teachers about books and about literacy, I think teachers have a certain responsibility too, to pick a couple of books and really sell that to kids, especially when they're young. You know, I always tell teachers that you have an advantage when you teach kindergarten children, first grade children, second grade children, that you can take Gravel and you could be like, I just found this book on Gravel. It's the most amazing book. And this book about Gravel is fantastic. And little kids are like, I love Gravel, you know, because they're enthusiastic about everything. So take a book. And if this is a book that you like, if you want, you know, children to learn about Amelia Earhart, sit down with your second grade classroom and take 3 minutes and say, boy, I just found this book on Amelia Earhart. It's called When Amelia Earhart Built a Roller Coaster. And I love this book. Let me tell you why I love this book. Look at this illustration of her when she's going down this roller coaster that she built herself. And so the teacher brings an enthusiasm that's genuine. Maybe they point out some amazing facts. Maybe they point out how Amelia was such like a modern day girl nowadays, but back in the day, and how long ago this was. And so they point out a few things, and then they say, I'm going to take this book on Amelia Earhart, and I'm going to set it on my display case. And anybody who wants to read it this week, just come on up and sign it out, or just come up during independent reading time and take the book and read it. And then you've kind of like done your job as a cheerleader for two or three books every week. And then, you know, your children, because they look up to you as a teacher, they're going to go and want to really read that book.
Yeah, my wife actually homeschools my 7-year-old son, and it's been fascinating to see her kind of grow with him and the way she teaches, and the way he kind of receives things is by enthusiasm. So you touched on that. It's really I think it's important that you did, because yeah, if you're really enthusiastic about sharing something with somebody, you know, especially a kid, I think that they're going to latch onto that, especially if they have a really good bond or relationship with you. If mom or dad or my teacher's excited about it, then maybe I should, you know, because, you know, mom and dad knows me best, or my teachers know me really well and they know what I like. And so I think it's so important for teachers to have that enthusiasm, I should say, and sharing that stuff. And I think that's a great way to do it. I think you make a great point there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we'll kind of segue into children a little bit more. Amelia Earhart, she loved kids. I mean, in my experience, in my research, and, you know, doing this project, you know, pre-research for about 8 years before we started it, she was great with kids, but, you know, she could also cuss like a Marine Corps DI. She could hang with the men. She was multifaceted in a lot of different ways. She kind of was able to walk this, this fine line. I was just talking with Susan Ware, who wrote a book on Amelia Earhart and The Search for Modern Feminism four weeks ago. Huh. And she had mentioned that, you know, she didn't really believe that it was a dual role, that Amelia just, this was just all encompassing on Amelia's personality and her, the way she was. Mm-hmm. But I wanted to ask you as an educator, what do you think Amelia Earhart, or why do you think Amelia Earhart seems to continue to speak to children 80 years later? I mean, I can't tell you how many, you know, 6 and 7 and 8 year old kids I see dressed up in Amelia Earhart cosplay, you know, mm-hmm. dressed up on the full plane and everything. It's just, it's incredible. It's the mind reels. And I wonder why, you know, you might think that she still continues to talk to kids 80 years after she disappeared like that.
Yeah, I think it's because of the things that you touched upon earlier, that she really is a bit of a superhero. I mean, like that, what she was able to do in a relatively short amount of time is pretty astounding. And, you know, I was just thinking about just the path of flight development, because I read David McCullough's The Wright Brothers book. And, you know, one of the main big points he made in that book was that not only were the Wright Brothers learning how to create an airplane, they were learning how to fly. Nobody knew how to fly because nobody had flown, right? So you had to do both at the same time. And when you think about Amelia going down that roller coaster, and then, you know, she was born in the late 1800s, and by the time she was flying across the Atlantic, plane development had gone like crazy. Like, you know, the models of planes were so far advanced. And she was able just to kind of jump in there in whatever it was. And you mentioned the, you know, the gyro, was it gyroscope plane?
Oh, it's the auto gyro. Yeah. Yeah.
Auto gyro. Yeah. I mean, like, she was able to jump in there and just kind of take command of it. And I think kids get that kind of stuff. Like they're able to see that she just did these things, that she went for the gusto and she did it. And I can't help but think too, that children, especially the girls, would see her as such a role model. That she was very modern day in 1908. I mean, she was just out there literally wearing the pants, you know, and running around and dreaming big and dreaming like that I'm going to do what the guys do. And even nowadays, women still don't have, you know, equality. They're paid less on average, and, you know, they're underrepresented in the sciences and mechanical engineering and, you know, in the tech field, et cetera. And so I think there's still a ways, obviously, to go with that kind of stuff. And Amelia was she was blazing the trail. And I agree with your acquaintance, your friend there, who was talking about it wasn't a dual role. It was just like that's who she was. And I think that's appealing about her too, that she seems like like not only genuine, but just like a really well integrated individual. Like, this is just who I am. This is what I do, and I'm doing it.
It's very true. It's interesting. I you know, I think she's, you know, she still talks to kids. I tell people all the time, you know, the reason why we do this project is, you know, is really for the young generations and for kids. And I can't tell you, you know, how many kids have been inspired by her, and how many people, you know, if you look at people like Amelia, like an Amelia Rose Earhart, who circumnavigated the globe and flew around the world. And you look at like Cassie Dey McCall, who just visited every country on the planet and was, you know, was the first woman to ever do that. Mm-hmm. These are women that have kind of taken and kind of, you know, her spirit and her soul, and kind of just ran with it and done the things that I think Amelia would be very proud of. Another one is Abigail Harrison, who wants to be the first person to step foot on Mars, and she's launched the Mars Generation. And, you know, it's just,
yeah.
These are fascinating young women who have done amazing things that have all drawn inspiration in some way, shape, or form from Amelia Earhart. And I think she still talks to kids now and says, you know, not only says it, but kind of lives it by, or, you know, kind of shows the example by her life that you can have, do, or be anything you want. There is no boundary. You know, I can't tell you how many no's and women can't do that she heard in her life. And not only did she do it, she ended up doing it better than anyone. And yeah. I thought that's very poignant. And I think it's a solid example to set now. I think it's very important.
Yeah, I totally agree.
What do you think ultimately her impact and legacy is today? I mean, I think, you know, we touched on kids, we've kind of talked a lot about different things in this interview, but maybe just in your own personal opinion, or what do you think her impact and her legacy ultimately is?
Well, I wish I was a little bit more well-rounded about her wide reading, but I mean, I think that, it, that legacy is what you just described to girls everywhere who then grow up in to be women who are blazing trails of their own. And I mean, it's a human condition. It's not limited to Amelia Earhart, not necessarily just to women, but women have their own special take and their own special talents, and they go out and they're doing things, and that they're using Amelia as this touchstone, then that's Amelia Earhart's legacy, that she is an inspiration to people who are just out there who want to do things, and they want to think big, and they want to accomplish things, and they want to move through their fear, you know, maybe not necessarily get rid of their fear, but have the power to move through it, not let it stop them. And I think that's a real legacy of hers. And at the very, not the very least, but as part of that, once again, to go back to my kind of America as opportunity kind of speak, that Amelia Earhart, she tried things. You know, we don't have to necessarily be the first person to set foot on Mars, and I'm never going to do that, or I'm never going to be an NBA basketball player or whatever for obvious reasons. But you know, even in my own life, there are things that I look to others to get inspiration for so that I can go out and then try to accomplish things on my own in my own kind of Mark Weekland scale. You know, and so for me, like a big thing to do was to quit my job, my day job as a teacher, and to make my own business. That was a huge step for me. And I was, you know, it was fear inducing and et cetera. And, you know, we look to people like Amelia Earhart, or because I've been writing all these biographies, Martin Luther King or whatever, and say, look at what these people did. Like, it's unbelievable what they accomplished. But the process or the line through to those accomplishments is the same line that I'm going to follow, which is like, I'm not going to let this intimidate me, or I'm not going to be fearful of it. I'm going to go into the future with an attitude of like, I can do this. And if I try and fail, well, that's okay. You know, Amelia Earhart spoke to that. Like, try, and if you fail, then just keep on going. Use it as an opportunity for the next thing that you do. So I think that's a legacy of hers.
Any last thoughts that you'd like to convey on Amelia Earhart or the book itself before we wrap up the interview?
Not particularly, other than I thank you for inviting me on to do this podcast. It's been great, and helped me go deeper with Amelia Earhart. She's a fascinating character, and just a wide world of biographies too. I think it's great to read about people and their lives and the way that they think and what they accomplished and what that means for us in our present day moving into the future.
Yeah, I would completely agree. Can you tell everybody where they can find this book online, they can follow your work online and all that good stuff?
Sure. Yeah. Any of the, like, you know, the online bookstore kind of providers, Barnes and Noble has my books. And of course, Amazon has the books that you can get it through there. You can go to Capstone Publishing and Picture Window Press and get it there. Also, you can do the old fashioned, go to your local library. You know, I can't say to people, support your library, folks. Don't just order from Amazon, but support your library too, because they're really important. And you can go to the library a lot of times. A library will have these books, and hopefully some school libraries, if not a lot of school libraries, have them. Online, you can follow me at my website. I have my business is Mark Weekland Literacy, and so that's my website, markweeklandliteracy.com. Just go there, and you can find out what new books I'm doing and what educational endeavors I have happening. And I tweet on educational and literacy issues, and my handle is at Mark Weekland. So it's MarkWeekland. It's all there. So you can find that all online.
Mark, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for sitting in on the podcast. We really appreciate it.
Oh my gosh, Chris, you're very welcome. And thank you for having me here.
I'm Chris Williamson, and you've been listening to the Chasing Earhart podcast. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook using the handle @ChasingEarhart. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts and subscribe, rate, and review this podcast.
Join us next week as we sit down with the host of Decoded and the author of I Am Amelia Earhart, Brad Meltzer. Thanks for listening.